The following is a collaborative episode of both the original podcast and Cinemantics. Enjoy! Hello, America, how are you?
Hello, America. How are you doing?
And welcome to something that hasn't happened in a long time. It's a collaborative episode of both the original unoriginal podcast
and Cinemantics, the podcast about movies good and bad, but mostly bad.
When's the last time we did one of these?
A long time. Independence Day.
Holy shit.
Like back in July.
Yes, but
we got some feedback that doing collaborative episodes
was counterintuitive.
Counterintuitive, as there are a lot of cross listeners of our shows. Is that even a real term?
I'll go with it.
I made it up.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me. So we should stop doing them so often, but this episode, I feel, warrants...
I think this will be our yearly edition that we definitely do this.
Yeah.
Because it is indeed the second annual Oscarsode.
Yay!
The 2011 Oscarsode.
You will recall we did this last year.
Yes, you had the poster, and I had Ben Stiller as Na'vi, which was horrifying.
Because it was...
But
not as horrifying as this year's Oscar show.
That's right, which you missed quite a bit of.
Yeah, I was actually performing in a flute recital. I wasn't playing the flute, I was playing piano for a flautist. But in any case, recital and post-recital socializing went longer than I anticipated, and I got back significantly into the award
show. With about an hour to spare.
But, I got filled in on what happened, and we saw some highlights.
We'll still talk about it.
We will, yeah. Since you saw more of it than me, do you want to kick things off?
Do we want to talk about winners first, or do we want to talk about the actual show?
The actual show. Okay. Everybody will be talking about winners.
All right, well, let's start kind of with a base of the fact that a couple days ago, or maybe it was a week ago, I don't remember, but it was announced that they were going to be trying something different this year at the Oscars. They were going to be a virtual tour of Hollywood, we were promised, with holograms in the style of CNN's election night coverage.
Because those holograms aren't distracting or obnoxious in any way.
Exactly. Because the Oscars need to be changed.
Because the Oscars need a gimmick. You know, when I posted on your wall, on your Facebook wall, when you said that. Because the Oscars really need a gimmick.
Yeah.
And tonight, I was mentioning the Oscars to someone, and I mentioned how they were going to be doing that, and their exact words were, "The Oscars don't need a gimmick."
No, they don't. However, for the best, and also kind of for the worst, that particular gimmick, they kind of overstated it. They kind of missold it. Because what we got, in fact, were a series of arches with a giant projected mural of a film scene on it. That takes about 4 minutes of time to set up and wastes everyone's time as all the audience sits in silence like, what the hell is going on?
Every Oscar show have something like that takes up too much time and...
Not as many things took up as much time. I mean, this was probably not as long as it felt. Because I think the record for the longest Oscar telecast is like 4 hours and 12 minutes.
Really? When was that?
Oh, God. I want to say it was like 2000 or 2001. But this year, I mean, it was about 3 hours, 15 minutes, give or take. But it felt longer.
It did feel very long.
You weren't even here, and you felt that it felt longer to you.
It did. It felt like 3 hours. Like, I had sat through 3 hours, and it was only like an hour and a half.
So I filled Nick in on what he missed. He missed this horrible MTV Movie Awards-style opening sketch with our hosts, Anne Hathaway and James Franco, going into Alec Baldwin's head Inception-style after he takes a Capri Sun flavored like Ambien.
That should be a real thing.
Which should be a real thing. And then traveling down an elevator with Morgan Freeman to a candy land where Alec Baldwin tells them that, oh, it was all James Franco's dream. It had, like, a disturbingly cutesy ending.
I just realized the fan
just cut off on mine.
And I also realized that little ending where it becomes James Franco's dream, that made me, like, cry a little on the inside.
And you weren't even here.
Wasn't even here, and you didn't explain that bit when we were talking about it.
This is true. Before you continue, let me go ahead and preemptively apologize for my fan, which is already working.
You'd think it wouldn't be, because you bought that anti-fan device.
I did. Let's move on, Nick, you were saying?
James Franco looked stoned out of his mind.
He certainly did, and you know what? He actually, I mean, he got less so as the night went on, but at the top of the show, homeboy was stoned out of his gourd. Just staring and squinting at the teleprompter and saying things in the most, like...
Drawling, laconic way possible.
Monotonous way possible, yeah.
But you know what? That just makes me love Jane Franco even more.
Because he realized that even he realized that tonight was bullshit.
Yeah.
And he was nominated for Best Actor in a motion picture.
In 127 hours.
Yes, which is only slightly shorter than this award show. I fucked that up.
Boom. I get what you meant, though.
If I were Billy Crystal, I would have made that joke with a zing and then maybe said some Yiddish after it.
Billy Crystal.
Who should have hosted, and as Twitter exploded tonight, the whole world wanted him to be hosting tonight.
And then he came on to sort of add insult to injury.
He did, and did a little comedic monologue about Bob Hope, which led to... Oh, we'll get to that.
Wow, we've really, like, zipped ahead, like, 2 hours into the show.
We have, but we gotta talk about the highlight or lowlight of the night, whichever one you prefer is correct. I speak, of course, of the Kirk Douglas 20-minute comedy hour. Which was one of the most horrifying things that has ever happened on television. Kirk Douglas, film legend, he's got to be about 92, thereabouts. He's a stroke victim, and he's in that kind of Dick Clark voice situation. But he's also really fucking old. And so he cobbles out with a cane. No, I didn't even tell you about all the cane comedy. There was cane comedy, Nick. Because he comes out there with his cane, and he starts telling all these bad jokes about, like, Hugh Jackman not laughing, and everyone's like, why are we talking about Hugh Jackman? This makes no sense. Like, he said, oh, look, Hugh Jackman's laughing, and we're like, why is that novel?
Why isn't.
It's not. There was no... And then he starts hitting on Anne Hathaway, and then he's supposed to present the award for Best Supporting Actress, and we do the nominee montage. And we come back to Kirk Douglas with his cane, where he whips out his cane and whips it over toward the tuxedoed usher guy, like, whips it in his face. And they do this weird thing where, like, they put hand over hand over hand over hand on the cane, and, like, the usher guy wins, and Kirk Douglas is like, I never win. And then, like, and then he pulls out the envelope, and he's like, and the winner is, and he opens up the envelope, and then looks up and goes, you know, and then does this, like, stupid shtick about, you know, old Hollywood that's just belaboring the fact. And then he's like, all right, but seriously, it's time for the... Oh, he kept saying this. It's time for the moment you've all been waiting for. The most important moment in the world. This moment is above all moments that are moments. And then moments like this are moments. He just keeps doing that.
Oh,
and then
I'm cringing.
And then he gets the envelope. He starts to open it again. You know! And then goes off into another comedy shtick. He does this four times. Belaboring these poor women who've been nominated for Best Supporting Actress, just waiting to find out.
Well, tonight we learned something about old Hollywood.
That it's fucking drunk and crazy?
Yeah.
And yeah, it loves...
took us on a tour
and loves cane humor.
Yeah. I never win.
That's right. But then after that, of course, Melissa Leo wins for Best Supporting Actress for The Fighter. Comes out. Drops the first and only F-bomb of the evening. Tape delay, so we don't hear it, sadly. But she does that, and Kirk Douglas is standing off to the side of the screen the whole time, just making everyone nervous. And then finally, when she's done with her speech, she goes over and she puts her arm around Kirk Douglas, and then he's not using his cane. Melissa Leo has her arm around him and is holding his cane, and is in many ways kind of making fun of him while she hobbles away with his cane. It was the most fucked up 20 minutes of television I've seen in a long, long time.
You know what's weird? I went online to try and find some video, and the one article I found was like, how great it was that we saw Kirk Douglas tonight. He was funny and delightful.
No, he wasn't funny and delightful. He was horrifying and made everyone uncomfortable. I mean, he's a Hollywood legend, and the tragedies of his condition may be what they may be, but that was some horrifying and awkward television that was not helping what was already an awkward, awkward evening. Especially considering, as I told you, the monologue, the Anne Hathaway, James Franco monologue, the comedy was so hacky, it was like a Catskills comedian mixed with Gallagher. Just awful. Just bloody awful.
Would you
awful.
Call it Hackaway?
No. As the fan amps up. Jesus. But anyway, What to say here? You, like I said, you missed so much of the show, and the thing is, I wanted you to be here so we could bounce our hilarious shenanigans off, but I know we have bigger fish to fry than just the ridiculousness of this show.
Right. I mean, apart from that, I mean, there weren't that many technical issues that I saw this year.
There weren't. As opposed to last year, there weren't a lot of moving set pieces that you could hear the steam coming off of them, and you could hear
and
electrical
cameras
sparks.
Dropping
and cameras dropping right before the presentation of a cinematography award.
Which you could argue is, like, post-ironic, like, brilliant.
Oh, it's genius. It's absolutely genius. Listen to the 2010 Oscar show, which I posted as a classic OUP selection.
One thing I will say is that ending was so stupid and unnecessary.
Oh, you ain't kidding. We had this whole night of really awkward timing and bad comedy and the random crap with the arches that was unnecessary.
It made it look like the stage was smiling.
That was the last thing that happened. They put out this row of TV screens that looked like a big smile with teeth. And then
TV teeth.
Ooh, the TV people. And then Steven Spielberg comes out and gives Best Picture to the King's Speech, which we'll get back to more on the winners and losers in a moment, but even before the commercial break, when they're like, coming up next, Steven Spielberg presents Best Motion Picture and a special tribute to the Oscars with P.S. blah 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 of blah 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 New York. And so Steven Spielberg presents the award, King's Speech people do their speeches, and cut to Anne Hathaway and James Franco, and is like, and now to encapsulate the magic of dreams, these people from New York. And then here comes this, like, these bunch of school kids singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And
everyone in the audience shoots themselves.
And the people, they're bobbing their heads like they're all on LSD, and it's horrifying.
And I hope they were.
It was absolutely horrifying. I stand by the fact that it was lip-synced. I stand by the fact that they just got kids to dance and mouth words.
I buy it.
Yeah. It was really, really awkward. But that was the show, in a nutshell. In about 12 minutes.
Shall we move on then to nominees?
Yeah, let's move on to this stuff and see if
that was sort of the meat of our discussion last year.
Yeah.
Okay, where do you want to start? Do you remember what order the awards were presented in?
I believe the first things to come up were art direction and things of that nature.
Okay.
Tom Hanks presented these awards, comes out.
Best art direction.
Art direction went to Alice in Wonderland.
Not surprising.
Yeah, I guess so. The fact that Alice in Wonderland was nominated for things did kind of perplex me, though, because Tim Burton didn't do anything more than just take the illustrations of, you know, the old, like, Lewis Carroll books.
John Tenniel was the guy who did those illustrations.
Right on. And he just took that and said, hey,
let's make them Tim Burton-y.
Exactly. Which you could have done, I don't know.
Yeah, but you need somebody to realize those ideas.
It's true.
And that's what these people won for. I'm not surprised that it was nominated for things. I think that Alice in Wonderland was a fairly underrated movie. I rather liked it.
I mean, it won for the things that it probably should have.
Yeah.
Art direction and costume design.
That makes perfect sense to me.
Did it win for... No, it didn't. That's right. But that's... We'll do technical stuff now. I think that's actually the order this is in, is like technical up to the stuff that people really care about. Yeah. We had Best Visual Effects went to Inception.
Which I call bullshit.
Do you know?
Kind of. Because Inception had that awesome stuff, like, with the...
Cities folding up.
The city folding up and all that awesome stuff with the stuff. That was a really vague sentence.
The cities and everything?
The cities and the dreams within the dreams and all that blah 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 blah.
And
but,
the spinning hallway with Joseph Gordon-Levitt kicking people?
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah.
But let's see what we've got it up against. We've got Hereafter, which obviously never would have won.
No, the only thing that it had going for it in terms of visual effects is one single tsunami scene.
Right. Which evidently must have been really good because it got it an Oscar nomination.
I honestly think that was more a matter of, it's a special effects moment in a Clint Eastwood movie. Let's put it on the Oscars.
Right. Then we've got Iron Man 2, which, a superhero movie is nothing but a visual effects extravaganza.
It's true, but in addition, they didn't do anything with Iron Man 2 that they really didn't do with the first one.
So,
I mean, no disrespect to Iron Man 2, because, you know, I'm a comic book nerd and I love those movies, but, you know, they didn't really, I don't know.
Push the envelope.
Yeah.
Then you got Alice in Wonderland, which is, again, nothing but visual effects.
It's true.
Like, the entire world had to be made up. All the costumes were, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything in that movie was a visual effect. And Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Yes.
Which is, again, incredibly visual effect heavy.
Yes.
And that was the movie that I was kind of hoping would win, because I'd like to see a Harry Potter movie get an Oscar.
You know, I there's part of me that wonders if it's going to be a situation above they give all the Harry Potter stuff to part two.
Hmm. Like they did for Lord of the Rings?
Like Return of the King, yeah, exactly. I think it's going to be a matter of that. If they're going to give anything to the Harry Potter movies to say, hey, thanks for the, you know, 12 years of entertainment, they'll...
It'll be part two.
Yeah, part two of Deathly Hallows, yeah.
I mean, I'm not disappointed Inception 1.
Right.
I mean, it the category this year was a fairly competitive category.
Yeah,
I could have seen the Oscar going to a number of things. I'm just sort of surprised that it went to Inception when it could have gone to another movie that wasn't nominated for Best Picture.
How do you feel about Inception now that it's been like 5-6 months since you saw it?
I've seen like part of it once since.
It doesn't,
I still think it was a good movie.
It was okay, but it doesn't like knock your dick in the dirt.
Like when it first came out, I was like, oh, this is better than The Dark Knight.
And, I don't care for The Dark Knight, I disagree with that.
And in the months since, I have thought to myself, oh, no, Dark Knight is actually the far better movie.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know.
I'll always have the tragedy of the fact that Inception was ruined for me before I got to see it.
Yeah.
By some horrible person on Facebook that I have since blocked. But, yeah, I mean, it's really sad. I'll never get Inception back. In addition, there was a short time where it threatened to be a bit of a B for Brady's.
Right.
So it never really had a chance.
Well, I saw Inception by myself in the theater on a rainy day.
No, we saw it together, sir.
I did see it by myself, though. Maybe it was for a second time.
You saw it twice?
Yes.
This is an awkward revelation that I'm going to have to edit around.
Did we really see it together?
Yes, we did. Don't you remember when we stood on the patio of my last summer home at the University of Choice, and I was
awkwardly
trying to figure out how I felt about it?
I'm trying to remember then what it was I saw. Maybe I saw Inception twice.
You probably did.
I probably did.
Best makeup went to the Wolfman.
That's gross.
Yeah, that's gross, said Kate Blanchett, which was amazing.
Compared to The Way Back and Barney's Version, which are two movies I've never heard of.
Barney's Version is that movie with Paul Giamatti, for which I thought he was nominated for Best Actor, but he wasn't.
Imagine the day when they expand all the categories to 10 nominees.
I'll be honest with you, I think that day is pretty damn close. I think if Best... Although, to be fair, I think it would be fair. Because if you're going to have 10 nominees for the big thing, you should have 10 nominees for all the second-tier things.
And you know what? The thing is, they made it 10 nominees so that they could include popular movies like The Blind Side last year. Ew.
Or The Dark Knight the year before, but they completely skipped over it.
Right. Yeah. Wait, haven't they only been doing the 10 nominees for 2 years?
Right.
Or is this the third year?
It's the third year.
Really?
Isn't it?
I thought it was the second.
I feel like I'm getting old because I'm forgetting things that happen like within a year. But
well,
the point is,
things that happen within a week.
Would you agree with me that they should equal it out for everybody?
Yeah, but then you get like a 6-hour award show.
Let's face it, would we not anyway?
Yeah.
With Kirk Douglas with his brand of comedy.
And I suppose the good thing about expanding all the categories is that it would force out all of the filler like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd have to.
That wasn't even meant to be filler. It was just meant to be, hey, here's this great Hollywood legend presenting an award to the lady stars of tomorrow.
Why didn't they, like, make him move it along after a certain point?
Because he's Kirk Douglas, and no one's going to say no to Kirk Douglas.
Fair enough.
I mean, that's really the truth of the matter. He was terrible and awkward and making everybody uncomfortable, but you're not going to shut Kirk Douglas up. He was fucking Spartacus. It's not going to happen.
Alright, best cinematography.
Best cinematography went to
Inception.
Inception. I was actually kind of expecting True Grit to take this one.
Really?
Mainly, I mean, True Grit was just made of giant shots of prairies. So I just figured that had to be a thing that
what
people paid
attention
to. What
about Black Swan? That's the one I expected to win.
Black Swan had its cinematographical moments. But, you know, it was very tight and very in your face. Like, it's kind of like everyone's argument against movies like Transformers, where they get so close that they allegedly can't see the action. But
yeah, but that
can.
Was kind of the point, though.
But that's what I'm saying, though. I mean, if everyone's going to bitch about it in one case, they...
See, but no. See, that argument is invalid. The analogy is false, as my grandfather used to say.
Okay.
Because in Transformers, it's just badly shot. You can't tell what's going on because the shot is bad. In Black Swan, that's the entire point, so that you can't see what's going on, so that he can surprise you with stuff. There's a method to the madness. Whereas it's someone with a plan versus Michael Bay.
See, I'm tricking you into liking Black Swan.
No, I'm just explaining.
I was perfect.
I'm just explaining why I thought the cinematography in Black Swan was better than, say, the cinematography in Transformers 2.
Yeah.
Okay, are we done with the technical?
I think we are. Let's move it up a bit.
Let's move it up. Okay.
Well, I'll be honest.
No, we've got a couple more technical abilities.
Sound editing and sound mixing, which someone...
Both went to Inception.
Exactly. Somebody tweeted that they should just mix them, which I absolutely agree. There's no reason for them to be two separate things, because they're pretty much the exact same thing.
Yeah, I guess I'd agree with
that. They really are. Just do best sound. Best sound design. That takes care of everything, I feel. But Inception did take both of those. And then we had music.
Yay, okay, I have some things to... I mean, like, this was a weird category for me, because I was trying to figure out who would win, and who did win is who I expected to win. We had, for Best Original Score, The Social Network, 127 Hours, How to Train Your Dragon, Inception, and The King's Speech. I didn't honestly expect Inception to win Original Score, because it was just another Dark Knight.
Wah! That's the score of Inception.
Yeah, it's the Dark Knight.
Yeah.
It's the Dark Knight score, which didn't win last year, so... Or did it?
I think we're getting our years messed up, sir. Let's just keep going.
I just don't remember if the Dark Knight won best score, but I don't think it did. But 127 Hours, I didn't really expect to win, because A.R. Rahman had already won for Slumdog.
Not A.R. Rahman, as everyone kept saying.
Thanks, Jennifer Hudson.
And it wasn't just Jennifer Hudson, it was everybody. Everyone kept saying that. It was annoying.
There's no C in Rahman.
Exactly.
So it's Rahman. A.R. Rahman already won for Slumdog Millionaire. Although, Gustavo Santaolalla, or however you pronounce his name, won 2 years in a row for Brokeback Mountain and Babel.
Yes.
So maybe he could have won again, but I doubt it. How to Train Your Dragon probably wouldn't have won just because it's a kid's movie, even though it was a great score. So that leaves us with Social Network and The King's Speech. I don't think Alexander Desplat has won before, although he might have.
No, I wouldn't know. But the winner was indeed The Social Network.
Because
Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Yes. Which, no big surprise there.
Which meant it was time for the second round of one of my favorite TV games. How weird does Trent Reznor look in a tux?
Is the answer very?
Not really. It's just very strange to see this guy who you're traditionally used to seeing like wearing all black leather with, you know, long hair and, like, pasty face swimming around in a sea of feces and the video for Perfect Drug versus this guy in a tux who looks kind of like John Corbett telling a buddy about how great music is. So it's very strange, you know, like...
And then here's another category that you had some problems with.
I don't have some problems with it. I'm just like, Best Original Song. The nominees were, of course, Coming Home from Country Strong for some fucked up reason. I See the Light from Tangled. I'll Rise from 127 Hours, and We Belong Together from Toy Story 3 by Randy Newman.
Indeed.
And, of course, Randy Newman won, which I was just like, listen, he won this same award for the songs he did for the first Toy Story. This is a year to give it to somebody else, and honestly, I feel like I See the Light as a better...
Toy Story won.
He didn't? He win, didn't win for, like, You Got a Friend in Me, or...
He won for Monsters, Inc., I think.
That may be right. You may be right.
He won for... I forget what that song was, but it wasn't a
Toy I wouldn't have nothing if it didn't have you.
Right.
Yes. But yes. Well, okay. I can kind of get behind that, I guess. I guess I am slightly biased because we did get to see Zachary Levi singing with Mandy Moore.
Right.
Which you missed.
I love Zachary Levi.
I think you would have loved it
However,
so much.
However, Randy Newman got up there and gave, like, the best acceptance speech of the night.
Second best.
The
guy who wrote the screenplay for The King's Speech, which we'll go ahead and tell you he won, he was so eloquent. He wasn't bullshitting. He wasn't wasting time with a lot of ums and ahs. And he wasn't, you know, like, oh, I'm so unprepared. What am I going to do? He wasn't doing any of that shit. He was just very well spoken and just, he went through it. It was very quick. Not too much ceremony, just enough gratitude and not enough, you know, look at me, I'm awesome. It was perfect. You know, it was just perfect.
Well, then, I can get behind that.
But Randy Newman, I mean, it was good in that Randy Newman way where he's being acerbic about the state of society.
And the state of Hollywood.
Yes.
I love Randy Newman. It was great seeing him trundling on stage at the end after all the kids started singing.
Yeah, that was the
they
one...
They lifted the veil and all the Oscar winners came out
That was
on
the
stage.
One good thing to come out of that Somewhere Over the Rainbow crap was all the winners coming back out to kind of take a bow.
Yeah.
That was cool. But the Somewhere Over the Rainbow, it was so great. If you were a listener of the of Cinemantics, you'll understand my reaction. Nick was clinging to me, trying to make me stay on this couch, and I was screaming, "It's Rachel Dawes! It's Rachel Dawes! Not again!" And it was just magic. Really bad.
We're really, like, plowing through these.
We really are.
It's okay.
I don't know why it took so long.
Do you want to talk about the short films?
I'll be honest, with all due respect, no. Because I didn't think so. I don't know what any of them are.
Oh, that's Luke Matheny. Okay. Remember
the dude with the Jufro?
Yeah, we saw. We were watching. Damn it, I can't speak. We were following people on Twitter live tweeting the Oscars.
Yes.
And Patton Oswalt, our
it was Grant Elwood.
It was Grant. No, I thought it was Patton Oswalt. It was Grant saying that Luke Matheny and Randy Newman should host the Oscars next year.
Oh, yeah, well, that was Patton. I was thinking of Graham when he said Jeff Goldblum, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh no. Yeah, Luke Matheny won for best live action short film God of Love, which looked terrible. Like the 2 seconds of it they showed.
Yeah.
And it won anyway. Anyway, he was a crazy Jufro. And we couldn't figure out who Luke Matheny was, but that's who he is.
Alright, but we also had the best animated short, which, the only thing in that list that I knew of was Day and Night, which was the short film that preceded Toy Story 3 in theaters, which I watched online.
You know what should have won? The Gruffalo.
I've heard a lot of things about The Gruffalo.
I have not seen it or read the book, but I think it should win because it's the book that the dad is reading to his son in the episode of Doctor Who entitled The Hungry Earth.
Oh my god, it is. I didn't even think about that, sir.
That is why it should have won.
Okay.
And I'm the kind of nerd who notices those small details. So.
But we move up next to documentary. Best documentary feature went to Inside Job, that documentary about the economic fall of the United States.
I've heard that is an amazing movie.
I've heard that as well, but I've also heard that Restrepo was better and that Waiting for Superman was absolutely robbed for nomination.
No, actually not. I read an article about Waiting for Superman. A lot of it was staged.
Really?
Evidently.
Is this like a recent development?
Yeah, that... No, it was... yes, it was recent that people heard about this, but... No, it should not have been nominated.
Okay,
it's not really a documentary.
I had no idea.
So,
but also nominated in the best documentary feature category was Exit to the Gift Shop,
which is what I expected to win.
Which I keep hearing about. I have not seen it. It's actually on Hulu, believe it or not.
Really?
Available to watch for free right now.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah, but the thing is, everyone keeps talking about this Banksy character. Justin Timberlake made a really bad Banksy joke to the point that Kevin Smith was like, "Listen, JT, just stop." On Twitter, he was just like, "Don't try again." No one was laughing the first time; like it was awkward. I guess Hollywood people wouldn't know who Banksy is.
Yeah. Although you think Exit Through the Gift Shop, I thought that made some waves when it
came
out.
I did too. I thought it was like the documentary everybody was going to be talking about this year, but
yeah,
I guess not. But documentary short subject went to Strangers No More. I don't know what that is. We have Best Animated Feature. Obviously, went to Toy Story 3.
If they'd been a less vanilla category when less vanilla voters, they would have given it to The Illusionist.
Yes.
Which is sort of like the next Monsieur Hulot movie, only animated.
What does that mean?
Okay, The Illusionist is an animated movie from France directed by Sylvain Chomet, who directed The Triplets of Belleville, which is an amazing movie.
Oh, yes.
And The Illusionist is a screenplay by Jacques Tati, who was a legendary French comedian. Like, he was sort of like the French equivalent of Charlie Chaplin.
Ah.
But his, like, shtick was in the 50s or 60s, maybe even, like, 70s, so he wasn't, like, a silent comedian. But his persona was this character named Mr. Hulot, who was just sort of like this bumbling French guy who was sort of good-naturedly wandered through all the scenes in his movies and mistakenly caused comical but gentle mishaps, you know?
Right.
And, you know, made comments about the world, you know? And Monsieur Hulot's Holiday is actually an amazing movie. But anyway, he wrote this screenplay called The Illusionist that he didn't get to make before he died, and Sylvain Chomet turned it into an animated movie. And I think that I imagine that a lot of people didn't see it, and that's why it didn't win. But really, I'm so tired of Pixar winning Best Animated Feature every year. I love Pixar, and they have yet to make a truly terrible movie, except maybe Cars.
I'm glad you said that. I'm so glad you said... Cars is the one that I'm just kind of like, no thanks.
Yeah.
Once was enough. You didn't change my life.
Yeah. I mean, except for that one. Yeah, they make great movies, but they don't need to win every year.
Are you aware of the plot of Cars 2, by the way?
Oh, God, no.
Cars 2 is the Pixar movie for this year, which means they won't win next year at the Oscars. So take comfort in that, I guess.
I will.
But Cars 2 is coming out this summer. The plot is that Lightning McQueen, Owen Wilson's character, is going to go on a world tour of doing races all across the world, and somehow his best friend Mater, voiced by Larry the Cable Guy, Dan yes. Whitney as it were, is going to get caught up in international espionage with a fancy British sports car voiced by Michael Caine. And it just looks like, it looks like Pixar's first major misstep. It really does. If you yeah. watch the trailer, it's just like, God, this is a Pixar movie? How the mighty have fallen. Like, there's nothing novel about Cars 2. To look at it, there's nothing novel. I mean, it could be argued that there's nothing novel about Toy Story 2 or 3, but at least there's something, I don't know, there's something of value, something of original, something of quality to Toy Story 2 and 3.
I think with Toy Story 2 and 3, it becomes less about the novelty and more about just how strong the writing is.
It's true. Versus Cars, which is just Doc Hollywood with Cars, and Cars 2, which is just looks like it's awful.
Yeah.
Like, everyone keeps clamoring for Pixar to make a bunch of sequels. Everyone keeps talking about Incredibles 2, which should never happen, because the first one is so fucking good. The Incredibles is my favorite Pixar movie ever. You want to know why? Because what? It's the one that isn't about taking a non-living object and turning it into something that has a personality and a voice so that you feel bad about throwing out your toys.
What about Finding Nemo?
I don't want to kill fish.
Yeah, but that's not like a non-living object.
I know, but then I start to feel bad about fish. I'm like, oh, fish, they're out there missing their parents.
And what about Wall-E?
Then I'm like, robots and fat people. I haven't seen Wall-E. I just know that's
Wall-E is such a great movie.
I've heard.
Well, Wall-E is like one of the greatest animated movies ever made for the first 50 minutes.
That's what I've heard that the silent parts are really, really good.
The silent parts are as close to perfect as you will see in a movie. The rest of it is just really good.
Yeah.
But just really good following classic.
With Jeff Garland playing a fat man in an egg.
Oh, I love Jeff Garland. I wouldn't mind seeing him host the Oscars.
I love Jeff Garland too. A matter of fact, just to date this episode, today I listened to the all new episode of Doug Loves Movies, on which Jeff Garland is one of the three guests. Have you seen this week's guests?
No.
Jeff Garland, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, and Dave Foley.
Oh yeah, I saw.
Holy crap! And it is a delightful episode. And Jeff Garland at the end begs to come back every week.
I love it.
He wants to be on the show every week. But I've been thinking about Jeff Garland all day, so I'm going to say this now for recorded history. You've seen the Comedy Central roast of Bob Saget, yes?
I have.
Do you recall when Jim Norton goes up for his bit and he turns to Jeff Garland and says, "Jeff Garland, how fat a man do you intend on being?"
Yeah.
I just love that phrase. I cackled out loud in the car just thinking about it earlier. I know that wasn't like worthy of the Oscar episode, but
whatevs.
It's very funny, and it's Jeff Garland.
Yes.
That delightful, portly Jew. Let's move forward.
Best foreign language film.
I went to In a Better World from Denmark, which was accepted by, I'm going to assume, the director Suzanne Beer, who looks like the Danish Katie Sagal. And there were, of course, the other nominees, Beautiful, spelled that way, you don't like. Which
yeah, I don't like it. Okay. It's a Mexican film by Alejandro González Iñárritu, director of Babel and Amores Perros and 21 Grams. Starring Javier Bardem. The Mexican word for beautiful is not beautiful spelled with an I.
It's Bella.
It's Bella, or, yeah, I think.
Yeah.
So,
sir, I took 7 semesters of Spanish.
So.
Okay.
To call it beautiful and then spell it that way is just one of those things that...
It's like the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah, they do it for either to be clever or indie or pretentious hipster, and I hate it when they do that. Just spell out the word like it normally is. You don't need a gimmick like that to carry your movie.
It's true. But can I talk about one of the other nominees?
Sure.
Dogtooth, a film from Greece directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. That movie, like, they did a montage course of all the nominees, and when they got to Dogtooth, there is one shot in that thing that made myself and your roommate James, who was sitting with me for most of this, just yelp in just utter shock, which was a man with a giant pair of gardening shears lunging at a cat, clearly about to behead it.
That's awesome.
And we were both like, what? Oh, it was magic. I tweeted immediately after, okay, how many people are going to go see Dogtooth now?
Yeah.
Just based on that shot, because what does that even mean? So I just felt that deserved mentioning.
Oh, of course.
Coming up, though, we have writing.
We're really plowing through these.
We are. I don't know how to feel about that.
I'm sure we've got some other things we need to talk about.
This is true.
When we get there, so.
Best writing for original screenplay went to The King's Speech, but David Seidler.
I could have sworn until I saw that I thought The King's Speech was based on a book about The King's Speech.
It was based on a book called History. You see what I did there? You see what I did there?
Yeah, I did.
It was
just... out of all the other screenplays there, the only one that had even a remote chance of winning, I think, was Inception. And they'd already given it a bunch of technical awards.
We were talking about this while you were gone. I don't think Inception is best screenplay worthy, because listen, the story is interesting, but the dialogue didn't really knock my dick in the dirt or anything.
And what about The Kids Were Alright? Which I haven't seen.
I haven't seen, but I really don't want anything to do with that movie. One, because I can't stand Annette Bening. And when it's Annette Bening and Julianne Moore, who I actually tend to like for the most part, when you put them together, though, it's like two women coming together to form one awful Sharon Stone. So I can't handle it. In addition, it just looks massively pretentious. And I'm also still kind of angry about, like I talked about this with the Golden Globes, about how they kept shoehorning non-comedies into all the comedy categories, which was really unfair. You know, it was just like, I don't... like it's definitely the weak link of all the nominees, all the nominations that it got, you know, for Best Picture and things like that. Definitely the weak link. But, yeah, there's just no interest. Just no interest whatsoever, never seeing it.
Okay.
But David Seidler, who wrote The King's Speech, gave, like I said, the best speech of the night. It was just so crisp and so perfect, and just no dancing around it, no stupid, oh, I'm stumbling and I can't hold this piece of paper. None of that stupid shit.
He was actually a writer, and
he was very eloquent and beautiful. And then Best Writing Adapted Screenplay.
Big surprise.
Went to The Social Network.
Big surprise. Aaron Sorkin. From the book The Accidental Billionaires by Ben Mezrich.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, yes, that's... I'm going to go ahead and put this out there, and I know this is going to kind of give some things away, but that's the last award the Social Network won tonight. So do you think it's time to talk Social Network?
Sure. First of all, let's finish talking the category, and then we'll do Social Network.
Okay.
Okay, 127 Hours, no, probably wasn't going to win, even though that movie was awesome. I saw it last week, and it was great. Toy Story 3, no. Wasn't going to win.
It's, yeah.
True Grit, nah, probably not. Winter's Bone, nah, probably not.
Here's the thing, and I'll say this quickly. True Grit, I could actually get behind the idea of it being like, if this were an actual ranking system, I could get behind it being number two. Because while, and I said, I kind of dropped this on you earlier, and it didn't really rattle your world, so I'm not going to go into it too much, but I didn't really care for True Grit. Which really stunned me. I just came out of it like, no thanks.
I didn't really care for it, man. Winter's Bone was an amazing movie.
What I was getting to was, the screenplay, it was classic Coen. Like, there was a lot, like, the wordiness and the weird, like, erudition of every single character.
Even the
stupid people. I don't know why, that struck me as interesting. That struck me as being worth my time. We'll have to talk about True Grit at some point at length, because just... how did you feel about True Grit?
I really liked it.
Like, do you feel that it, like, deserved all this praise that it was heaped on it?
It deserved all the praise. I feel I'm glad it didn't win any awards, because I'm not sure it was, like, really award-worthy, but I'm glad they recognized it. Like,
yeah, I can kind of get behind that, but just, like, something about it didn't sit right with me. It was... in a weird way, it felt too short. Not enough happened. I know it was based on a book, so I'm taking issue with the story of the book, which I guess with me, I wouldn't care for the book either, but it was too short, not enough happened. It was kind of blah, and like that whole first 20 minutes where she just goes and keeps talking to that dude about a horse was boring as hell, and I don't usually say that about movies. I usually give movies the benefit of the doubt. I never use boring as a reason to not like a movie. I never do, because I think that's kind of, you know, that's just kind of low class, but it was so boring. That first 20 minutes was so boring, where Hailee Steinfeld just kept going to the father-in-law from My Two Dads and talking about how she wants her horse. And then I got to talk about Josh Brolin, because that was the other linchpin.
Not Matt Damon?
Not Matt. I love Matt Damon. Did you not?
I'm just curious.
I really liked Matt. Actually, I thought Matt Damon was more memorable and more intriguing than Jeff Bridges, which is surprising. I really did. I thought he I don't know, he felt... I don't know, just... I liked Matt Damon, but Josh Brolin?
Can it was you... an odd performance.
I'm glad you think so. What the hell was that voice?
I do not know.
There is no reason for that voice. Josh Brolin is badass enough on his own to play that
unless
character.
Unless there was something in the book that made him behave.
If there was, I'll give it the benefit of the doubt. But if there wasn't, then what was him? I remember seeing you down the road. I'm Josh Brolin. It was that garble. It was like Kirk Douglas with a higher pitch. It was just like it was really weird. And I remember, like, I went to see it with my mother, as it were. We sat next to each other, and as soon as he came on the screen and started talking, we both looked at each other like, why is he doing that? Why is Jonah Hex talking that way?
Oh,
Jonah Hex.
Oh, you made a Jonah Hex reference.
I'm going to go ahead and put this out there in the ether, and I'm sure people are going to give me shit for it, but I'm like the one person in the world who saw potential in Jonah Hex. I watched that movie, and it was only like 80 minutes long, which is part of the reason why it wasn't overall good. But I really feel like there's a director's cut of that movie out there that's awesome. Like, I feel like the problem with Jonah Hex, if I may go there for a moment, was the fact that they cut too much. Because I feel like they intended to make an R-rated movie, and Warner Brothers said, no, it's got to be PG-13, so cut everything awesome out.
I could see that.
I really feel like that was his problem. I think if it was rated R and they got to keep everything they wanted, it would have been about a little over 2 hours, and it would have been one of the most popular movies in the summer. But as it was pretty bad. But it had a lot of really interesting ideas that I would have loved to see fleshed out.
See, that's a much more fair assessment than I've heard anybody give Jonah Hex. So.
People, well, that's because people kept hating on it solely on the fact that Megan Fox was in it, which is no reason to hate an entire movie.
Wasn't she in Jennifer's Body?
Yeah, the reason to hate that movie is because Diablo Cody wrote it, okay?
Oh! Like,
you don't hate that movie because Megan Fox was in it, you hate it because the screenplay was shit. But I haven't gotten to say that in public, but I will defend Jonah Hex to the ends of the earth. That movie, there's a better movie living in that movie than people ever give it credit for. And you know what? John Malkovich was fucking awesome in that movie. He was the villain, and he was just classic, crazy as fuck Malkovich. It was gorgeous. I kind of want to watch it for our podcast sometime.
Let's do it.
I really quite enjoyed it. But that was True Grit. But Social Network.
Yeah, it won.
It won Best Adapted Screenplay. Here's the... do you want to talk Social Network?
Sure,
now?
Let's do it.
The Social Network is a movie... It is clearly becoming my new Dark Knight. I mean, Dark Knight is still, as we mentioned on your last episode, no, 2 episodes ago for you, or however many long it's going to be. I don't know when
before this is posted.
Before this was posted, when we talked about the Dark Knight, I made that statement about how, like, I'm going to have a weird relationship with the Dark Knight, but at least I'm going to have a relationship with it.
Right.
Like, that was my statement, and I stand by that. Like, I'm going to have a relationship with that movie. I'll just feel differently about it every single time, you know?
Right.
But with regard to the Social Network, okay, here's to understand why I'm going to go ahead and start with this opening statement. I don't want to see the Social Network if just not for a while, if ever. And to understand why that's a thing, you kind of have to take a trip through my 2010. I'll do this very briefly because we've done this on both of our shows countless times and very long-windedly. But the Social Network, here's the situation. 2010 was the year I realized I hated Facebook. A lot. You know, I just fucking hate it. Because you've heard me say it multiple times, especially recently, like, why can't we just meet people as people anymore? Now, there's a certain facet of my life currently that the development you learned of today that I'll go ahead and tell you was an online discovery. But that's neither here nor there. It was a rant I had. And I've had some problems with people misusing Facebook, but I'm saying all of this now because I don't want people to think my reason for not wanting to see it is out of hatred for Facebook. I mean, it doesn't help, but it's not the reason. Because you tell the story, tell your story.
Okay, that was a rambly beginning. The Social Network came out, and I had no interest in seeing it. I was like, who wants to see a movie about Facebook? And I had heard some people that I know had seen it and were like, oh, it's a really cynical movie that doesn't do Facebook any real justice. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to see it. I'll probably see it on DVD, but I don't want to pay to see it in the theater. And then my professor, who gets all the Academy screeners, had it, and we watched it in class, and I loved it. I thought it was the best movie that I'd seen all year. Not my favorite movie of the year.
That's still Scott Pilgrim.
Still Scott Pilgrim versus the World, but the best movie, I feel, of the year was The Social Network. And when I wrote on Facebook, oh, I love The Social Network, Jeff was like, I don't want to see it, and we'll leave it at that. And I was like, well, don't hate it just because you think it's the Facebook movie. And that really upset you.
Yes, it did, because I was thoroughly insulted, because you've heard me in countless conversations give you multiple reasons why I never
wanted
to see it.
And yet I couldn't remember any of them, and so that is the reason I picked.
Okay, well, we're going to keep going. Well, here's the thing, okay? We're going to go through the more shallow reasons first. Yes, I don't want to see it because I do feel... Listen, if you're going to make a movie about something that exists, like Facebook, whether you're doing a cynical, dark story about Mark Zuckerberg or not, you are glorifying Facebook. You are doing it, whether you intend to or not. I don't want to watch something that glorifies Facebook because I don't care for Facebook. I know that people are like, well, why do you use it? Burger, burger. Because, as I said in a previous episode of one of our shows, it's like internet job applications, or internet in general. You can't... Our world is so used to the internet, like, our world is so dependent on the internet that, like, you can't do anything that doesn't involve the internet anymore. As a person of this generation, you can't do anything that doesn't involve Facebook anymore. Everyone has Facebook, and it is sadly a crucial part of everybody's social experience now. It's unavoidable, you know? So it's not a matter of, you know, why do you use it? It's a matter of, if I don't, I'll be completely lost in the mire. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's either do it or die. Basically, so I have no fucking choice but to use Facebook. So I have a bit of a grudge against Facebook, and like I said, I don't want to watch a movie that glorifies it, even if it is glorifying it in kind of a cynical light. The other reason is, and it's a common recurring reason for a lot of things on both of our shows, is the fact that it's become a bit of a beef over ratings, which is a phrase that we've used on the OUP and Cinemantics on a number of occasions. I'll briefly explain it very quickly once again. There is a restaurant in my hometown. In my senior year of high school, I have lived in my hometown, give or take the years I was at the University of Choice, for 24 years. I know that town very, very well. I lived there, for God's sake. This restaurant opens when I'm 17, called Beef O'Brady's, and everyone in town starts going to it, and it's basically kind of like a low-rent, local chain TGI Fridays, basically. And I just don't care. I'm not interested. Nothing draws me to it. It's not interesting to me. Weeks go by, and then I have people starting to tell me, oh, have you not been to Beef O'Brady's? Oh, you don't know, insert my hometown's name, if you haven't been to Beef O'Brady's. And I'm like, fuck you! How long have you lived here? 3 years? 17 years, motherfucker! I know my town. And so I got really insulted, you know? And so Beef O'Brady's has become this indication of this, of anything, but a lot of times mostly pop culture, where someone will say, oh, if you don't like this TV show, you don't know TV. Or if you don't like this movie, you don't know movie, which, as we've said millions and millions of times, you don't say that to Jeff. That is a massive insult and is just bullshit. Jeff knows movies and Jeff knows TV. He knows it very well, and if you tell him he doesn't, you're full of shit. I'm sorry for all the profanity, but the point is, you know, why would I be sorry about profanity? I love profanity. But you know what I'm saying. It was just, that's a Beef O'Brady. So The Social Network became one of those things. Because let me tell you about my social network journey. Remember, we saw the first trailer, I think, with Inception last summer. And I remember we both had the same reaction where we were both like, I don't want to see this. I don't want any part of this. You know, that was the first trailer where it was just all the pixels becoming Jesse Eisenberg's face.
Right.
The picture that was eventually the poster. And then there was the second trailer, which I remember this came out around the time we saw Patton Oswalt live, because I remember us having a conversation about it.
Didn't we see this in the theater together at some point?
We saw this with a different movie, the second teaser.
Mm-hmm.
We saw the second teaser in the theater, but I remember we were talking about it walking toward the theater where we saw Patton Oswalt. I remember having this conversation with you where I was like, you know what? I really have no interest in seeing that movie, but that second trailer, which to those of you who may remember, is the trailer where it was just a kind of a montage of the things that were happening in the movie with this Swedish, like, private school choir version of Radiohead's Creep over it, which was really good. Just a great trailer, and I stand by it. It's my favorite trailer of last year. You know, we were talking earlier about how I love not just a well-placed song in a movie, but a well-placed song in a trailer.
Mm.
And that was definitely a great case of that. And it was such a well-edited trailer. Like, it made a movie that I had zero interest in seeing look awesome, but still not to the point that I would see it.
Right.
Although I will give it the benefit of the doubt that in that conversation we had before Patton, I swear I did say at one point, maybe I will see it. Now, I had that in my head, that little seed of maybe I'll see it for a little while, and then it comes out. And I'm not, like, when I said I might see it, I didn't mean I would rush out to see it opening weekend. I meant if there was something else, if there was nothing else I wanted to see one weekend, I would go see it. That happens sometimes. It's happened a lot in January. And that was my plan. So we go to a former acquaintance of ours' birthday party, and we're all sitting on the porch of this place, and it comes up, The Social Network, and everyone keeps talking about it, and I keep hearing all these different, you know, arguments for and against of why you should see it or not. And at the time, to its credit, there was a lot of difference in opinion. You know, there wasn't a universal everybody's got to see it kind of vibe yet. You know, there was still room for discussion. But that sort of died about 5 minutes later. I don't mean like literally 5 minutes, but by the next day on Facebook, damn Facebook, it's everyone telling me I've got to see this movie. It's everyone telling me that I'm not a person if I haven't seen this movie. And especially, and I say this with love to all of you, but a lot of my former comrades in the film department of the University of Choice, like, just being real snooty about it. Just making it sound like the thing I don't ever want to do, you know? So that kind of went on for a while, and so from that point it became a beef over Brady's. I didn't want to see it because I was being told over and over and over that I'm not a person if I don't see this fucking movie. And that was where that stood. But I do have other reasons. And I'll finally get to those after that long-winded story in which you have said nothing. Nick, you're also hosting Cinemantics right now, so say something for your audience.
Bong, biggity, bong, bong!
Ding a ding dong, bong, bong, bong! But anyway. So anyway, we get to the more intellectual reasons why I don't want to see it. Okay. And this, I mean, this is still kind of petty, but I'm going to go with this one first. I remember when that movie came out, Aaron Sorkin, of course, the screenwriter of the picture, a fella whose works I actually tend to enjoy, because I'm a big fan of Sports Night and a big fan of Studio 60 and the Sunset Strip. I'm a big fan of his work. But I will say that his dialogue gets a little full of itself sometimes. A lot of people will say that. It's kind of a common idea. But he writes this movie, and he does a talk show tour. He goes on Letterman. Most notably, he goes on The Colbert Report. And I remember watching him that night, and this was shortly after a lot of people had accused his screenplay of being really sexist. I can't confirm or deny, so I'm not going to touch that, because I haven't seen it. But just the way he talked about it, he just came off like the most arrogant cock you've ever met in your life. And I fucking hated him. I was like, you arrogant son of a bitch. I don't want any part of your business. So that was another petty reason, I guess. Now, as for the movie itself, and this is based solely on things you can see in a trailer, which I think is a good enough reason. Why else would they make advertisement if you aren't supposed to gauge from what they're telling you in an advertisement whether or not you want to see something? Okay? So I see trailers and advertisements, and I see all this stuff, and I see this story that just looks a little cartoonish. Looks a little bit... It looks like a fantasy world where it just does not exist, where inventing Facebook makes you, for lack of a better term, and I would never use this term in any other reason, but for lack of a better term, it makes you into a pussy magnet. It makes you into just hot stuff. All the girls want you because you invented Facebook. And one of our favorite people in the world, Mr. Chris Hardwick, you love him as much as I do, if not more, and they're rare. Chris Hardwick, he was talking on his podcast, The Nerdist, once about The Social Network, and he said, you know, the one thing he didn't get about The Social Network is that, you know, people don't get laid for writing code. That's bullshit. He called bullshit on that. He's like, no, that does not happen. And I was like, yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And
although, in the movie's defense, he invented Facebook, not just some random
quirky
website.
Who gives a shit?
No. If you went up to someone and said, I invented Facebook, that would earn you some cool points. I'm sorry, it would. And also, it doesn't really earn him that much... I don't want to say it. It's such an offensive word.
It is. Pussy?
Yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't... It earns him that...
Let me... Okay, let me reiterate, though. We never use that term.
The thing that really struck me about The Social Network when I saw it was how antisocial Mark Zuckerberg is the whole movie. He is so insanely focused on his computer program that, like, his human connections with the world are, like, so flawed and almost non-existent. It's sort of strange that this man would make a social website.
He's made the social networking website that lets people sit on their fat asses at home and never speak to another person.
The point is, the overall point, though, is that it's not that whole, like, pussy magnet thing is not really that valid an argument.
Okay.
So, sorry, Chris Hardwick.
Alright, well, that one's probably also a little too cosmetic. Let me put this to you. I don't believe... You know, okay, I'll tell you the scene that always made me go, really? There's the scene that we kept seeing in all the trailers. Of course, Justin Timberlake plays Sean Fanning, right? The guy who invented Napster?
Sean Parker.
Sean Parker. Why would he not... I thought his name was Sean Fanning.
No, that's Dakota Fanning.
No. There's a guy named Sean Fanning out there who did something with the internet.
we'll look it up.
Okay, well, anyway, the guy who invented Napster. That is correct, yes? He plays that guy? We keep seeing that commercial where they're in some boom, bam, and dance club, and he's like, it's our time! And it looks like something out of fucking Notorious. It's like, he's not Biggie Smalls, he's Jesse fucking Eisenberg. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, there's nothing banging and ravey about venting websites.
Well, the thing is, within the context of the movie, that scene makes more sense.
I'm sure it does.
Because the whole thing is...
But you get what I'm saying, though? They make it look like inventing websites or inventing Facebook is like... It makes you P. Diddy.
Right.
Which is bullshit. Even you gotta admit that.
Well, yeah, but in the movie, he's trying to impress Jesse Eisenberg because he's like...
He's trying to get in on the action.
He's trying to get in on the action because he's one of those guys who lives the decadent rich lifestyle when in reality he has no money. He's one of those guys, and Facebook... I mean, in Facebook, he sees the potential to make tons of money.
Right.
And at that point in the movie, Mark Zuckerberg doesn't want any advertising because he wants to keep Facebook cool. You don't want to see a bunch of ads on a website. So he's not really doing anything with advertising, and Justin Timberlake comes in and he's like, I see potential to get in on this before someone else does.
Right.
So that whole sequence is basically him seducing Mark Zuckerberg.
Okay. But you see what I'm saying? Like, that environment, though.
Right.
That concept, the idea that... Just like I refuse to believe that. But also, there's just the flat out fact that there's a lot of embellishment to that movie, and even you've got to admit that.
Well, Zuckerberg himself has called the movie fiction. That's not so much surprising coming from him, but
and actually, to his credit, he doesn't say that in any sort of snarky way. He just says, "Yeah, it's fiction,"
and I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah.
I think that it's a great story in its own right, and it's told very well, and yeah.
Okay.
I don't watch a movie based on real things expecting it to be accurate. Movies just aren't.
All right. Well, listen, sir. I think we have come to a conclusion here.
Okay.
And that conclusion is that all I have are cosmetic reasons.
I think that once you see the movie, you may come to appreciate it.
But
if
you,
not love it.
Well, listen to me. Do you understand why I need a while?
Yeah.
I need as long as it takes... For everyone to stop Beefo Brady'sing this movie. I need all the Vote for Pedro t-shirts to go away before I can like this movie. You know what I'm saying?
Right. I mean, given your contempt for Facebook, I doubt it's a movie you'll ever love, maybe. But at least I think you'll see its merit after watching it.
Here's the other thing, though, and I'll talk about this. Because, you know, we've been kind of the duking it out with words about Social Network was kind of the big selling point of this episode for a long time.
Well, now we've got another movie to duke it out over.
It's true, but you know, one of the things I said when I was teasing our conversation about this to each other
right.
in a chat was the fact that I originally had this, I'm not going to lie to you, I was originally going to prepare a statement. I had a whole stage show I was going to give you where I was going to pull out a slip of paper and then take off my glasses. And then put them back on and then start reading a prepared statement about why I was never going to watch The Social Network, or at least not until January 19th, 2027, which would be the day after my 40th birthday. The reason why I arbitrarily picked that date when that was still going to be a thing was because I just wanted to pick a time when both the crap that happened to me last year involving Facebook was gone, like really fucking gone. And I'm like married with a couple kids and have like a life to care about. Like, I have a life beyond the bullshit socializing of Facebook to not have to care anymore. Although this is the other thing I will say, and I want your thoughts on this. Even as a person who liked the movie, can you agree with me on something I'm about to say, or just kind of get what I'm saying? I just feel like, in a general sense, the story of how Facebook was invented could have waited until a little more than 6 years after it was fucking invented.
Yeah, but then it wouldn't have been that prescient.
No, it would have, because then it, because regardless of whether or not Facebook continues to thrive, and the sad part is it probably will for years and years and for maybe forever. But the point is, by 20 years from now, Facebook is going to be, is still going to be a legend. You know what I mean?
Right.
That this thing that took over the fucking world. And I feel like with 20 years time, or even just 5 more years to 10 years, just not 6 years later. I feel like with that kind of time to really think about it and just really put all these things into perspective, we could have gotten a much more interesting, and I feel, in a weird way, much more retrospective and, in many ways, kind of timely movie.
Well, yes and no. Because the movie doesn't try to really...
Like, I want... You know what I'm saying?
I want to see it
as a historical document.
Right.
I don't want to see it as, this happened 6 years ago and your life still sucks because of it.
That's not what the movie's about, though. The movie's not trying to be a retrospective of the impact of Facebook. It's simply how it was made.
But even that, I would prefer to see 10 years from now.
And the power struggles and whatnot that were involved in it. The movie doesn't really analyze the long-term impact of it or the impact of it globally. That's the sort of movie, yeah, they should wait to make. But this movie, that wasn't this movie's, you know, reason for being. So I guess they felt now was as good a time as any.
Okay. Well, anyway, the long story short here, too late, is I'm willing to watch this movie. Okay? I'm willing to see it with an open mind, but like I said, it's not going to be anytime soon. It could be a year from now. It could be 2 years from now. It will be sometime soon in that perspective. It won't be 20 years from now. I was being a dick, but it'll be within the next 2 to 3 years. If you can live with that. Or it could be within 40 episodes. Because, you know, Dark Knight was your first season finale. Maybe it could be your second.
Boom.
Who's to say? But I guess it's time to finally move on. That didn't feel like as much of an epic battle of words as I expected it would be.
It wasn't. But that's alright.
I'm going to ask you a question, Nick, and you can be completely honest as my best friend in this world. Do I come off as an ass sometime with some of my ridiculous ideas?
I wouldn't say ass. I mean, like, maybe... I can't think of a word that doesn't sound mean or insulting. Like, never mind. I can't think of a way to phrase it.
Okay.
It's just sort of like, some people, I guess, okay, I get it. Okay, some people might say it, but that's because they don't know you.
Okay.
Like, somebody who doesn't know you at all, and just heard that whole tirade about The Social Network would think, those are all stupid reasons, and he should just see the movie and make up his mind. But I know you, and I know the way your mind operates.
Okay.
So, it all makes sense to me, so no, you don't come off as an ass to me.
It's just, in many ways, it still ties back to that big, grand, overarching theme of both of our shows, which is that marketing fucks a movie. Even if it's not the marketing it does itself, because clearly that's not the problem. That second trailer, once again, my favorite trailer of last year. Whereas now it's, in that perspective, it is a matter of just, it's word of mouth. It's poorly put together word of mouth. That's the problem. It's Beef O'Brady's. Forget it, Jake, it's Beef O'Brady's.
Interesting juxtaposition of references.
Yes.
Shall we move on to...
Yeah, I suppose we should. Murmur.
Okay. We're up to the acting categories now, so we don't have too long to go.
Yeah, we're up to Best Supporting Actress, because we already mentioned Melissa Leo won for The Fighter.
Who shouldn't have? Haven't seen The Fighter? I would have given it to Helena Bonham Carter.
I would too, actually.
Because...
Actually, I would have given it to Hailee Steinfeld.
Oh, you're right. I would have.
Because she fucking carried True Grit. She was the star of that movie, and the mere fact that she was put on Best Supporting Actress is kind of stupid.
It is. She should have been Best Actress. But I guess they felt that putting her in Supporting maybe would have given her a better chance to win.
I guess.
And also because she was so young.
I don't feel like that's good enough reason.
No. Yeah, I would have given it to her, but I feel like Helena Bonham Carter has been in so much stuff now.
Yeah, I can absolutely agree with Helena Bonham Carter.
She was so good in the King's Speech.
And I gotta tell you, every single clip I've seen of Melissa Leo in The Fighter, I love Melissa Leo, but every single clip I've seen of her in that movie just looks like a bad... It looks like a parody of Boston. It doesn't look like real Boston, it looks like a parody of Boston.
Yeah.
And she looks like she's playing the parent of, like, Jimmy Fallon and Rachel Dratch's characters from Saturday Night Live. Remember when they play those characters that were from Boston?
No.
You are. You're retarded. You are. And they start making out. That's the she was their mother. You know? They weren't right. Brother and sister. That was a weird incest idea then. But still, you know what I'm saying. But yeah, there was that. But then, of course, Christian Bale won Best Supporting
Actor.
Actually,
I'm not done with the category.
Oh.
There's a really surprising addition to the category, which is Jackie Weaver.
Yes.
Nominated for Animal Kingdom, which was an Australian crime drama, which I saw a few months ago. And she is the best part in that movie. And I love that she got nominated, because she was so good.
Yeah.
And it was in this little movie from Australia that no one saw.
She was, of course, nominated for a Golden Globe for this as well.
Yeah, I think it's weird that... Have you heard anything about this movie? Like,
very little other than what you just said, Australian crime drama.
Right. I mean, it's alright.
Yeah.
Like, you'll know me, I write little capsule movie reviews on Twitter. Mine for Animal Kingdom was the message of this film supposed to be crime ruins lives? Well, it's been done better.
Yeah.
Because that was really the only thing I could, the only moral I could impart from that movie was crime ruins lives.
Right.
And it's been done better. But she was awesome, and I like that the Academy recognized her, because they so easily couldn't have, or whatever. Anyway, now we can go to Best Supporting Actor.
Which, as I said, Christian Bale won for The Fighter.
Wrong.
I agree. It should have gone to Jeffrey Rush. For his part as Lionel Logue in The King's Speech, a movie I just saw 3 days ago. No.
He was awfully good.
3 days ago, yeah.
I could have also lived with it going to John Hawks for Winter's Bone.
You kept saying that.
Because he was so good in it.
Yeah.
Winter's Bone is a really good but really depressing movie about this girl trying to find her father in the Ozark Hills, and all of her family's in, like, the drug trade, so none of them will help her because they're so protective of their drug money and stuff.
Right.
Like, it's a movie where drugs affect everything and everyone's relationship in the movie, and yet you don't see drugs at all in the entire movie.
Right.
Like, it's just sort of an idea, like this menacing philosophy that's twisted this family, and it's a really good movie. And John Hawks plays the main character's uncle, and he's like this totally conflicted character who he's just an amazing performance. And I feel like they should have he should have won.
Right.
That's all there is to it. The Fighter. The only reason it got so much attention, I feel, is because it was a David O. Russell movie.
I agree.
No offense to David O. Russell, but all I have to do is see the trailer for The Fighter, and I'm like, that is The Wrestler, but about boxing.
Exactly.
And I guarantee you that The Wrestler did it better.
Having seen The Fighter, I would agree.
Because the trailer makes it look so derivative of The Wrestler.
Actually, you know what? It's not even that. It was a matter of the first time I saw a trailer for The Fighter, I laughed. Out loud. I was like, seriously? What? That looks utterly just stupid. And then it starts getting all this attention. I'm like, that stupid movie is getting all this attention?
Maybe it's actually really good, but I'm going to go on record now and say I doubt it.
I doubt it as well.
So,
I just... nothing.
We'll see. Yeah. Jeremy Renner already run for... Wait, did he win?
He didn't win last year.
He didn't win.
Which, there was a part of me that was like, maybe he's going to pull out a surprise tonight, because...
But he didn't.
He didn't. But I'm glad he's still a guy that people are paying attention to.
Oh, yeah, I agree, because he was so good in Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
All right, now, we're at the big four.
All right, we'll just start with Best Actor.
Okay.
Best Actor, which your nominees were James Franco for Hunting the Trojans 27 Hours, if I could speak English, Jesse Eisenberg for The Social Network, Jeff Bridges for True Grit, Javier Bardem for Beautiful, and Colin Firth for The King's Speech. And, of course, he won, Colin Firth.
Which is no surprise to
me. Not at all.
I wouldn't have been upset if they'd given it to Jesse Eisenberg or even James Franco.
Yeah.
Because both of them are incredibly good in their respective movies. Jeff Bridges just won, so no. And they're not going to give it to a guy in a foreign movie.
Exactly.
And also, Javier Bardem won already for No Country for Old Men. So it basically boiled down to Colin Firth, and the only one who realistically could have given him any competition is Jesse Eisenberg.
That's one thing about the Oscars that I kind of don't care for, is the fact that we do have this
idea... It's just like an elimination game.
It is not just that, but it is that idea of, oh, he won too recently.
Right.
I feel bad that that's a thing that we have to think about. You know, I mean, we all do, and it is a legitimate way to think of it, but I feel bad that that's a thing.
Yeah, like you think it should be whoever gives the best performance wins.
Truly, yes.
So even if it's Jeff Bridges 6 years in a row, maybe other actors should be as good as Jeff Bridges.
It's, I mean, they do it with TV all the time. Alec Baldwin won the Emmy for 30 Rock, I mean, deservedly so, but for like 3 years running, John Lithgow won for playing Dick Solomon on Third Rock from the Sun like 5 times in a row. You know, like, I'm just saying, like...
The Emmys do it right?
The Emmys do it right.
Huh.
Golden Globes don't do anything right. But the Emmys do everything right. Except for giving, you know, Emmys to Modern Family.
Well, I think that the Academy Awards has a bit more bureaucracy and...
Which is really fucking unfortunate.
Yeah. Than
because it is the
things.
Fucking Oscars. It is the top dog. It needs to be... let's just stop talking about bad things. Let's move on to Best Actress, which this was no surprise. Let's just... Screw nominees. Natalie Portman won for Black Swan.
Gee, big surprise.
Not a surprise, and I just saw Black Swan 2 weeks ago.
Okay, I do want to give some shout-outs, though.
Okay.
Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone was unbelievably awesome.
Right.
She was so good. I would not have minded had she won, because she was like a force of nature in that movie.
Yeah.
Annette Bening, no.
No.
Nicole Kidman, no. And Michelle Williams, I want to
see
Blue Valentine.
You're going to reserve judgment because...
Because I am actually interested in Blue Valentine and I want
to
see it.
I'm really glad that somebody, and I know this is a weird way to put it, but I'm really glad somebody from Dawson's Creek went on to do something productive.
Productive?
Like, or
well, Joshua Jackson's on Fringe.
I mean, not productive was the bad term. I mean, do something good.
Right.
Because, I mean, Vanderbeek... It's the beak. He, I don't want your life.
Has he done anything, like, since The Rules of Attraction?
He did a Hallmark Channel original movie with Doris Roberts.
Doesn't count as a thing.
Actually, he's going to be on some sitcom this fall on ABC where he's going to be playing, like, a fictionalized version of himself.
That could be interesting.
Yeah, it sounds...
Although, haven't we seen, like, a million of those same shows
like
and movies?
Like, 30 Rock, God bless it, but Liz Lemon and Tina Fey. And then, and like... Remember that show, It's Like You Know, which is one of the dumbest titles of a show ever, which Jennifer Grey was playing herself?
Jennifer Grey.
Yeah. But Vanderbeek's going to be playing... Joshua Jackson's been on Fringe, and people like Joshua Jackson. Were you aware that Joshua Jackson almost played the part of a teen-to-adult Anakin Skywalker?
I didn't.
Wouldn't you have preferred that? I could have gotten behind that.
Maybe. Maybe.
I've thought about that a lot. But anyway, no, but then there's Katie Holmes, who was Rachel Dawes in Batman Begins and still should have been in The Dark Knight. But now, she, like I said, as I said many, millions of times before, she's a stay-at-home hostage.
She is.
It's the best way to describe it. But Michelle Williams, who would have thought? The least charismatic of that entire cast goes on to be one of the better actresses of our generation.
Well, good for Michelle Williams.
I like it a lot, and I like her style. I like that she's rocking that short blonde. I like she's, you know... She's going for this kind of old-time Hollywood deal, which I'm totally behind. I'm on board.
Boom.
But yes,
so
Natalie Portman, Black Swan.
Let's talk about Black Swan.
Let's please talk about Black Swan.
Because in the wake of The Social Network, this is the movie that has raised the most contention between the both of us. Because I saw Black Swan last night and hated it.
Yeah, I know you did.
Hated it.
I saw it 2 weeks ago and loved the pants off it.
I know you did. And I wanted to love it, because everyone I knew was like, oh, that's such an awesome movie, you have to see it. I'm like, I will. I need to see it before the Oscars. Everyone I know had seen it and was really in the Black Swan. And I knew that, even without seeing it, I knew that Natalie Portman was going to win. So I wanted to see what all the buzz
was
about.
That was perfect.
She was.
Yeah, she was.
And the movie, unfortunately, was not.
It was if you go into it looking for what I was looking for.
We're going to go through what I didn't like, and then you can counter all of it.
I didn't want to counter. I just want to ask you this question. What were you expecting? And don't just say, a good movie, bruh.
I was expecting a psychological thriller.
Okay.
That tackled themes of madness and duality seriously and intriguingly.
Okay, well, in a weird way, this is a situation where word of mouth and promotion actually worked to its advantage for me.
Okay.
Because in the weeks that it... Actually, it's been longer than a few weeks. It's been out since, like, October, hasn't it?
It's been out for a while.
Like, in select theaters and finally getting wider and wider and wider.
It's finally got a wider release.
Like, I remember when it first came out, like, we heard a few things. I remember seeing the first trailer for it last spring and thinking, that looks fucked up. I want to see it. But then it came out in select theaters sometime last fall, and then it kept getting wider and wider and wider. And every time I would hear something about it, I would hear a different thing. But one of the recurring things I was hearing was that it was really campy. That it was really, like, kitschy. And you say camp and kitsch to me, you've just won my heart. So I was like, I'm so fucking in.
See, I didn't think camp and kitsch.
I had heard nothing but camp and kitsch. And I was like, really? I'm totally in. So I go to see it.
See, there was nothing about the movie that felt campy or kitschy to me, because those two words to me imply really low budget.
Not necessarily.
Tacky and sort of tasteless.
Okay, those may not be the best terms to use, because I do tend to routinely use them to describe WWE, so...
Like, that movie took itself so seriously.
I don't think so.
Okay, you're gonna have to tell me what you think about this movie.
Okay, I gotta tell you my experience. Like, I went into that with those months of hearing these more and more gradually being told that it's a camp kitsch kind of movie. So I go in there to this movie... And I should mention that I saw it at this arts theater in my hometown, which is surprising enough that my hometown is an arts theater. But even more surprising that it's, like, less than a mile from my house, which once you see my town, you'll understand. But it's an arts theater, and they're doing an Oscar month. So I go to see Black Swan. It's the same place I saw King's Speech this week. So I go to see Black Swan. I'm in the back row in a full house of nothing but old people. And I'm the only person in the back row, so I just have free reign to watch all of their reactions. It was glorious. And the movie keeps going, and it starts out, it goes on the first 15 minutes, and the only way you can describe it is it's so campy. Because it's so ridiculous, like, I know that as the story goes on, you come to realize that this is more part of the psychological aspects of the movie, this idea that Barbara Hershey is trying to keep Natalie Portman as a child, even though she's like 30, you know, like, it's...
See, the thing is, I told you this last night, I thought the movie would have worked a lot better as a drama. Like, because
I don't think it's supposed to be a drama.
No, it wasn't supposed to be a drama.
I think it's supposed to be a satire.
Horror. See, you say that about a lot of things, but I'm not sure it was. Let me finish.
Okay.
The idea of this ballerina trapped in, like, this life by her domineering mother, living vicariously through her daughter's career, and this sexually repressed young woman having to find these aspects of herself and overcome that to play this role in the ballet... could have made for a really compelling drama, and it still could have had a weird, dark ending where, like, she tries so hard that she, like, hurts herself and...
Possibly dies
at the end anyway.
Spoiler alert.
Without any of that random, second-rate Cronenberg body humor, body horror bullshit.
Which you kept saying, but as I told you earlier, before we even started recording, before the Oscars even happened tonight, I kept saying I had never heard of that there was a thing referred to as body horror until
I'll
yesterday.
Just explain it for people who like you, may not be familiar with it.
I had no idea that was a thing.
Okay, Canadian director David Cronenberg is widely regarded as launching a brand of horror movies called body horror, where people have horrible things happen to their body. Like, usually it's transformative. Like, in Videodrome, James Woods, basically, his stomach sort of transforms into a VCR, that looks like a vagina that they shove VHS tapes into, and his hand becomes this horrible-looking gun thing. And in The Fly, which is, like, the ultimate example, Jeff Goldblum, over the course of the movie, like, his fingernails peel off and goo shoots out of him, and his skin starts getting all moldy and gross, and he turns into a fly by the end of the movie. And it's the most horrifying special effects you've ever seen. Like, they're really disgusting movies. But that's the point. Because it's supposed to evoke this really visceral reaction from you. Like, oh my god, they're becoming something that isn't human. And that's what's frightening about them. And Black Swan has those moments where, like, she keeps seeing, like, scratches on her back. Or there's that bit where she's peeling the skin off her finger.
Yeah.
Or she's pulling feathers out of her back, and you see, like, these rippling textures in her skin that aren't human, or her toes are webbed together for no reason. It's like, it starts down this road where, oh my god, is she actually becoming a swan? And then backs off for, like, 40 minutes to do something else, and then comes back to it for, like, one shot, and then backs off for another 40 minutes. And if they wanted to go down that route, which is, in my opinion, a valid enough route, they should have, like, went with it. Although you could have called it The Swan instead of The Fly.
Right.
If they actually had done that. But you know where I'm going. You get what I'm saying.
I right? do, actually.
So, like, it felt, if you're going to have an idea like that, actually develop it instead of just, you know, cutting back to it every once in a while. Hey, we're still doing this, you know. Because, like, there was a lot of stuff with blood, like, in various points of the movie. With her pulling the skin off the finger.
Stop describing that, by the way, because that's the one thing about that movie that almost made me vomit.
Right, and her slicing her finger open with the scissors, like, the scratching on her back, the blood stuff. The blood would come back, freak everybody out, and then they wouldn't do it again for, like, 30 minutes. And, like, it was such... The horror in that movie, if you can call it the horror, was so schizophrenic in the way it just jumped back and forth. And then they started doing the more standard...
Well, it was schizophrenia.
And then they started doing the more standard psychological thriller mind games, like seeing weird reflections in mirrors and, like, having hallucinations, which aren't frightening, by the way.
No, listen, that's the beauty part of this movie, sir. I was never scared. Like, I didn't view it as horror. Whether Darren Aronofsky knows it or not, or whether he intended it or not... He made the best parody of his style that anyone could have ever made.
So you consider it a parody of a Darren Aronofsky movie?
That was one of my original conclusions. The point, I love this movie, and I can't quite completely tell you why, but just I know that I'm probably not loving it the way I'm supposed to, if I am. I'm loving it in a way that only Jeff can. that maybe I can teach you how to. Which is, okay, like I said, let me take you through my experience. Like I said, I'm in that theater full of nothing but old people watching their reactions. And back at the room, movie starts. Like I said, the first 15 minutes, like I said, we talk about this whole thing about Barbara Hershey being domineering. Which, by the way, I have an argument that perhaps that was also part of her hallucinations.
Barbara Hershey?
That Barbara Hershey was a terrible mother. I think that perhaps Barbara Hershey was a good mother and she imagined all the bitchiness.
Yeah, but again, why would they do that? There's like no impetus for her being crazy. Before Vincent Castle is like, you need to explore your darker side.
Because she doesn't get laid enough?
Yeah, about that. I got a couple things to say about that as well. The movie really oversells the sex.
It does, but it's part of the reason why I love it, because it's so ridiculous.
It's a valid point that sex would be an important part of this sexually repressed woman's journey.
Right.
But the way they use it feels almost exploitive rather than revelatory.
Which is part of the reason why it's so fun to watch.
And the thing is... All of this subject matter has been done before in Roman Polanski's Repulsion, which came out like 40 years ago in like the 60s, and is about a sexually oppressed young woman going crazy over like the course of a weekend trapped in her apartment. And it is one of the most freaky movies ever, and it does it in a really organic, believable, terrifying way. It's Black Swan just sort of feels like a remake of it, set in a ballet studio and without any of the subtlety or interesting imagery.
Okay.
Anyway, continue.
So anyway, I think...
I'm sort of like steamrolling you without letting you trying to continue.
A little bit. It's okay. But yeah, the first 15 minutes, we do have those weird scenes, like the thing with the cake, where Natalie Portman gets the part in Swan Lake and her mother gets her this cake and then she says she doesn't want one and her mother freaks out and she's like, fine, we'll just throw it away! And just like starts to dump it and be like, no, I'll take it. And then she goes and bombs it up. One of the things I told Nick about as I was watching this movie listen, Nick, I want to tell you something. In your defense, I wasn't liking it for the first half. I wasn't liking it in a way that I should. And indeed, in the end, I probably still aren't. Or am not. I can't speak English. The point is, I still aren't. What the hell is that? Anyway, we had that first 15 minutes. We had all the stuff about sexual oppression. We have Winona Ryder being crazy. You know,
casting in that movie was really odd, too. Like, it was odd.
I loved it.
It was odd seeing Winona Ryder do those things.
Play the aged ballet star?
Yeah.
I'm totally down.
Yeah,
I saw her on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon a couple months ago, and I would say that she has not aged well, because she sounded like... Have you seen all the Back to the Futures?
No. Or maybe I have. I don't know.
Okay, there's a scene in the second one where Marty McFly goes to an alternate 1985 and sees his mother, and she's like... She's pretty much like cracked out with breast implants, and like she smokes a lot, and she has this really like grainy, grizzly voice with that Leah Thompson way about her.
Right. So
it's like, you know... Oak Park Cemetery! And it's like, it's that weird voice. And that's how Winona Ryder talks now. And I was like, oh, what the hell happened to you? So seeing her in that movie after that totally made sense to me. I was like, she's fucked. What the hell happened to you?
She's nothing! Nothing!
No. That's not what she says when Winona Ryder is stabbing herself in the face with a nail file. It's, I'm perfect! I'm perfect! It's a precursor to the whole thing about I'm perfect, or I was perfect.
Oh. Well, I ruined that.
It's fine. But listen, I'm defending this movie because I just enjoyed the hell out of it. I'm not saying it's good. I've been saying I enjoyed the hell out of it because listen, I'll tell you here, there's a flaw in that scene with the nail file, which is that they never explained why is it that Natalie Portman, when she gets in the elevator, is holding the bloody nail file like she was the one doing the stabbing. They never explained that. Ever. Ever. So I'm like, listen, there are things about that movie that go by completely unexplained, but there are things that are so damn ridiculous, they are so fun to watch. Like, or just you have to learn to have fun with it. Like, one of the things I told Nick about was that as I was watching the movie, like, as time would go on, just piece by piece, I kept coming up with these ridiculous, like, capsule synopses for this movie. The first one was, an artsy-fartsy hypochondriac has finger injuries, both real and imagined. Like, that was my first synopsis. And then it was things like, you know, and then it was, you know, an artsy-fartsy hypochondriac has finger injuries, both real and imagined, and really needs to get laid. Like, it was just, it kept growing and growing and growing, and then it just kept happening throughout the movie. And then, like, there are things that, yeah, I was like, why does this keep... Why is this supposed to be weird? Like, the finger injuries. It, and just fingers. Over and over and over. Like, oh, every time they would cut two fingers, I was like, oh, I bet they're gonna get injured somehow.
And they do.
And they always fucking do. I'm like, oh, God, what? How's the finger gonna get injured this time? I had so much fun, Nick. You have no idea. And then the mirror shit. Holy crap.
It happened too many times.
It happened like 80 billion times. Every time Natalie Portman would stare into a mirror, she'd turn her back and then her reflection would do something different. And so, like, every time she would stand in front of a mirror, I was like, oh, I bet her reflection's going to do something different. Oh, it did. Like, it was so fun,
see,
Nick.
You went into it and started making fun of it halfway through in your mind.
Yes, and had a gay old time, sir.
It's not that you actually enjoyed the movie. You liked making fun of the movie.
Yeah,
and I think you like the movie because it's make-funnable.
Yeah.
Whereas,
I guess that is it.
See, I never had that realization.
I was
just busy rolling my eyes in my head.
I wish you could have had that mindset, man. You would have had such a good time. It's so fun.
I should watch it again from that mindset.
I fucking love that movie. And listen, Natalie Portman was great. Like, in the midst of all this camp and kitsch, she gave an amazing performance.
Oh,
which was undeniable.
I'm not disputing her.
Yeah, yeah,
and who else was great in that movie was Mila Kunis,
yes.
I don't get why they felt the need to throw the lesbian sex scene in there.
I will tell you about, well, I'll explain that. Which, spoiler alert, it turns out that was a hallucination too, in a way.
Because everything in that movie was.
But I think the implication was that part of the reason why Natalie Portman's character was so resistant to Vincent Cassell's advances was because she was gay. I think that was part of the story, because, and even when there's that scene where she and Mila Kunis go out to some bar and they're just chatting up two regular dudes, just chatting it up, she's not enjoying it in the way of, hey, I'm a girl meeting a guy that I might want to date. Well, he's charming enough. I guess I'll entertain him for a while while Mila Kunis is over there making out and spiking my drink. You know, like, it's that's what that was. I think that one of the things that no one's saying about this movie is that Natalie Portman's character was gay. I can totally get behind. And I think that part of the reason why her sexuality is repressed is that perhaps, like, I'm still on the fence about whether or not Barbara Hershey was indeed a bitchy mother or a controlling mother. I think... I could go either way on her. Like, the reason why I say that is, we're just going to spoil these movies to death. So if you're listening to this, just...
I'm sure everyone who cares about Black Swan has seen it by now.
Okay, but there's that. But in the last scene where she ascends the stairs and is going to commit suicide as the White Swan, when she looks out in the audience and she sees her mother, and her mother is, like, looking, like, supportive. Like, she came there to see her and she's very happy for her.
Yeah.
That was the moment where I was like, well, wait, does this mean she's been, like, supported the whole time and Natalie Portman's just been a crazy bitch? Like, is that the big story here, that Barbara Hershey's actually a really great mother and Natalie Portman's just nutlog and hate crazy?
I think established that she's nutlog and hate crazy to her supportive mother when she, like, breaks her hand on the door and then, like, crushes the broken bones again to get out of the house.
This is true. The only moment where, the only thing that makes my Barbara Hershey is actually a good mother theory wrong or questionable is the scene where, after Vincent Cassell tells her she needs to go home and masturbate, she goes to her room and she's just touching herself like nobody's business, rolling around in the sheets.
I didn't buy that.
And then she rolls over and Barbara Hershey is sleeping in the chair.
I did like that shot a lot because it was, that movie, one thing I did like about this movie is that it played a lot on the whole thing of the world of the movie only exists within what you can see of the frame. Like, when you're watching a movie, you can't see what's outside the frame, so that part of the world can't exist.
Yeah.
And this movie plays with that so many times. Like we were talking about the cinematography, it being so close to Natalie Portman all the time, it almost creates this sense of claustrophobia. So when she turns around, the camera whips around with her, and then all of a sudden something will just be there in frame.
Right.
Like, she turns around, oh, bam, Winona Ryder's right in her face. Oh, she's masturbating. Bam, mom's in chair. You know, I like that. I like that.
Yeah.
That. I'm not sure I bought that such a repressed woman would, you know, be so into humping her bed that way.
I don't know. Maybe it was the first time she touched herself in a while, or
that
maybe
felt,
even ever.
Yeah.
And
so
she was just kind of overcome.
Well, I don't know. That felt gratuitous to me.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit exploitive with those, like, shots of her thighs.
This is true. Well, let me go ahead and put this also out of the disclaimer, since we're talking about this very, you know, this subject. Nick, you know me well enough to know that the reason why I enjoyed these scenes had nothing to do with, you know...
I know. I'm just saying, as a guy...
with Natalie Portman masturbating or Natalie Portman and Mila Kunis having sex. So I've never been that guy who's like, ooh, lesbian's hot. I've never been that guy. Like, I'm more like, ooh, love hot. Love of any kind.
Right.
I'm like, I appreciate the act of love. That wasn't love. That was just Mila Kunis tongue-fucking Natalie Portman. So, like, like, that wasn't anything more than that. And so, like, I like camp.
Right.
So, the big overarching point here is that movie was campy as hell with an amazing performance, and I loved it. And I hope that there will come a day where I can get you watching it the same way. Because I'm telling you, watching it the way I did will be a revelation to you.
We should, like, make a Rocky Horror Picture Show sort of things to say at the screen.
I don't know about that. My last Rocky experience wasn't that great.
Because, I mean, well, I was thinking in my head, there's only so many times you can watch it in that mindset, because you'll eventually learn all the stuff that happens in the movie, like... Oh, a better reflection's gonna move. Like, you know it's gonna move because you've seen it so many times. So the only way you can continue to really mock it is to make up stuff.
Well, I will also say this about my enjoyment of that movie. And I don't know if you felt this way, and you probably didn't, but even camp and kitsch, all that being said, it was very involving. It kept
really?
Me interested.
One of the words that I was going to pick until evidently I learned it wasn't a real word was uninvolving.
That's a real word.
Not according to dictionary.com.
Oh, well, I had no idea. Anyway, the point is,
like my spelling check programs kept saying, not a word!
Well, either way, it kept me interested. I was, like, interested to see what was going to happen next. Admittedly, it was a matter of, I wonder how she's going to hurt her finger next. I wonder what her reflection is going to do in the mirror next.
I didn't care, because the story was so weak. Like, it didn't really give us that many, like, interesting... It didn't flesh out her character enough to make any of what was happening to her... really that
well I think that that's another thing that I was,
needed to explore the source of her neuroses.
I think
to make them more compelling,
I think this could also be another argument for Barbara Hershey was a good mother.
Okay.
Which is, I think it's entirely possible that we came into Natalie Portman's psychosis in medias res. She was already kind of half crazy, and we came in like in the climax of her insanity.
Okay.
Which would mean that all the stuff about the character development, we don't know this girl well enough to understand why she's going crazy. It's a matter of the fact that maybe we just didn't see that part.
But wouldn't you consider that a flaw?
No.
Why not?
Because sometimes in medias res is fun. If you're like me and you just went in there to watch a movie in which Natalie Portman goes batshit insane and then ridiculous things happen, then you won the day. So, like, you know... like,
yeah, but if you don't give us a suitable groundwork for the character, how can you care about her? It's like, oh, she's crazy.
I don't think you're supposed to care about her. I think you are supposed to.
Then
watch...
why watch the movie?
Because you're like, God, she's crazy.
Look at your face.
Listen, Nick, I can't express, an audio can't put it forth enough how much fun I had watching that movie. Fun.
Or at least half of it.
No, all of it.
You didn't say you didn't like the first half.
Well, because by learning to love the second half, I learned to love the first. I figured out exactly what I should have been doing at the second half. And when that happened, it kind of put the first half into a new perspective for me. Where I was like, oh, that was... I bet if I'd been thinking this back then, 45 minutes ago, I'd been having a hell of a time. And then retrospectively, I did.
Right.
I love that movie, sir. And I'm not going to regret it.
Well, maybe one day, even though we already said tons of shit about it, we may cover it.
I'm sure we will. But you want to talk about Best Picture and Best...
And Best Director.
Which go to the same picture, The King's Speech!
Yay!
Which is a film I saw 3 days ago and loved quite a bit.
Let's just go over quickly the nominees just for, you know, final two.
Sure, go ahead.
Tom Hooper, The King's Speech. You were talking during the movie. The show that James Cameron had dyed his hair brown and didn't have facial hair anymore, and he looked really freaky. And when Tom Hooper came up to accept it, you're like, oh, that's who I thought James Cameron was. Yeah. So that's Tom Hooper.
He looks so much like James Cameron, it's ridiculous.
And there was T-Bone Burnett last year who looked just like James Cameron.
It's the running theme.
Who's it going to be next year?
Yeah, John Larroquette?
Oh, God, I hope
we can
so.
Only hope. He's already halfway there. If he's got some facial hair, he looks exactly like him in a weird way.
James Cameron lookalikes.
Oh, imagine.
Anyway, we had Darren Aronofsky for Black Swan. If nothing else, Black Swan was a well-directed movie.
It was.
The Coen brothers for True Grit, of course, because it's a Coen brothers movie. David Fincher for The Social Network, obviously. And David O. Russell for The Fighter.
The way he mistreats his extras.
Yay! Anyway, I think it's sort of interesting, the evolution of David Fincher, because he did like 7 in Zodiac.
Go even further back. He did Alien 3.
And Alien 3.
Or Alien Cube, as they say. He didn't need to Fight Club.
And then he started doing these movies like The Social Network and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. It's like all of a sudden he's a completely different director.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Like that joke that Patton Oswalt tells about a dark, dank David Fincher-esque kitchen doesn't really make sense anymore.
No. Yeah. Now it's just a clean kitchen.
Yeah.
So
where maybe they're wearing well cleaned robes and eating not Celador breakfast treats, but really fancy French biscotti. Two people got that.
But
Tom Hooper did win the day here.
And he won the day for Best Picture.
He did indeed.
Because even though the producers come up and accept the award for Best Picture, I still consider it the director's show.
Oh, certainly, yes.
So anyway, the Best Picture nominees this year were The King's Speech, which, as we said, won, 127 Hours, Black Swan, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids Are Alright, The Social Network, Toy Story 3, True Grit, and Winter's Bone. Which is, in general, a pretty strong selection of films.
It is. It really is.
I don't think I would have put Toy Story 3 in there, because that goes to the animated category.
Exactly. I don't think I would have put The Kids Were All Right in there.
And I'm not sure I would have put The Fighter in there.
Yeah.
I might not have even put Inception in there. But then you have to fill out a 10-film category, and what else would you put in there?
Which, like I said, it is kind of a double-edged sword, because 10 nominees does open the door, but also opening the door kind of makes even less sense when it's kind of a moot point.
Right.
When The King's Speech and The Social Network were the two movies that everybody said were like the toss-up to win, the other 8 nominees just become pointless. I mean, I know you can't have somebody come out and say, let's face it, America, these other 8 aren't going to happen. Let's go bring it down to these 2. Grudge match, bitch. Bow! They have those 2 football helmets clash into each other. Big Tostitos logo, you know.
I'd love to see, like, 1 year the Oscars done as, like, a football game. Like a cheesy football game.
Yeah.
With John Madden as the host. Now The Social Network moved up. I can't do John Madden.
If Kirk Douglas opens the envelope and The King's Speech wins it, that's going to be an Oscar winner.
With the arrows drawn on screen. Like, multiple circles around one object.
Yeah.
That would be odd.
I'm so sad there was an opportunity to bust out my impression of Frank Caliendo's John Madden. That's a depressing day for entertainment. Oh, God. But yes, The King's Speech did win. How did you feel about The King's Speech, sir?
It was alright. I thought it was a good movie. It was a really good movie, actually. But I didn't feel it was as good as some of the other movies in the category. I felt like it was a movie that people were making more important than it actually was because the acting in it was so good.
Right.
And because it was a period piece and because it was about an important subject, kind of. Like, oh, this king at the dawn of World War II, but it's also personal.
Yeah.
You know, like, but it just didn't feel as good or important to me as The Social Network or even 127 Hours, which would have been like my third choice.
Right.
Because I thought that was such a great movie, even though Slumdog Millionaire only just one, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't have minded seeing Winter's Bone win either, because that was another really good movie. But again, one of those movies that I think won mostly because it was the most popular.
Right. Here's the thing about the Best Picture category, especially considering it's got these 10 nominees. Let's do the count. How many Best Picture nominees did you see this year?
7.
I only saw 4, which is actually less than last year. So I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I know anything enough about Best Picture nominees to tell you which of these was best, because maybe The King's Speech wasn't the best. But I will tell you about The King's Speech in my experience, which is, that was a very personal experience. I went in there because, it's a British movie, so of course I'm going to have some affection for it. 2, I've heard nothing but good things. Kevin Smith speaks very highly of it, which you kind of wouldn't expect in a weird way, but at the same time you would. But the thing that really, what kind of ended up really driving the point home as I was watching it was the speech itself. I'm watching this movie where this guy, King George VI, has spent his entire life being made fun of by his father and his brother, who are just two Class A dicks.
Basically.
But played by Michael Gambon, who surprised me, and I was very happy to see him, and Guy Pearce, respectively. And, you know, he spent his entire life being made fun of, and you know, going through all this strife and hardship, and just with his stammer, and then it comes time for him to deliver this speech. And I got really emotional because I'm not calling myself King George VI or anything, but I'm him. I felt a very kindred spirit with King George VI because, not to get too personal, but I started thinking about, you know, my entertainment life. Not to get too proud of myself, but you know, I had a pretty rough childhood. You know, I really did, with the school system in my hometown and certain things that happened with my family. And I've had a pretty rough couple of years, but one of the things that kind of kept me going was I got that radio, I started working in radio at the radio station at the University of Choice. And there was this one party that I've talked about a number of times on the show, I think, Christmas of 2009, where it was a party at a friend's house, just this end of semester party. Everybody's really happy to see each other. It's just a really good night to just be among friends. And that was the night that I realized that my radio show had fans. And in a weird way, that was a massive revelation. You know, like, I'm doing this radio show on this college radio station, and, you know, college radio is notoriously not necessarily the most listened-to medium. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was nice that I had all these people, when they would hear my name, they're like, oh, you're the guy who does blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, that's me. And it was a really nice feeling. It was like, after all these years of people kind of dragging me down, it was nice to have somebody say, you know what, I dig what you do. And so I'm watching this movie, and I'm watching him, you know, get through this speech, and everyone's so happy to see him, and like, he's just around a sea of smiling faces and people that all love him and have nothing but respect for him, and just, he's loved. I got really fucking emotional. I kind of needed a moment in the car after the movie, before I even started the car, to kind of tamp down my emotions, because I was about to start crying, because I was just, I felt a very kindred spirit with King George VI, overcoming a life of hardship to be a great man with a voice. That sounds so self-serving, but I really felt that, and it was kind of like my reaction to the end of Lost.
Boom!
That went nowhere, did it? Didn't it?
No. It explains why you love The King's Speech.
I love The King because it really hit home.
So good.
I really felt for King George VI's story, and Colin Firth was amazing. Jeffrey Rush was a delight, and Helena Bonham Carter, who Kevin Smith kept pointing this out, and I kept watching throughout the movie for it. Was there's something about the way she plays this character? Like the slightest furrow of her brow shows so much emotion. And I kept watching for that particular facet, you know. And it was there, and I was like, ooh, wow. Yes.
You know, she was really
She was fantastic.
Good. Again, would have given her the best.
I could totally be behind that. That's totally possible. Yeah. The King's Speech.
The best film of 2011, according to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then that wacky-ass show that I wish I had more to say about.
Yeah, without the technical difficulties, you can only bitch so much about the weird concept.
And the truth of the matter is, and I'm not mad at you, but you not being here, there's not much to say when you weren't here to see a lot of it.
Right.
You weren't here to watch the, you know, watch James Franco come out stoned out of his mind, and as the night go on, grow more and more cogent. And you weren't there to see Kirk Douglas's weird shit, and you weren't there to see the utter asininity of the dome effect with the murals, which actually died down as the night went on. Like I said, the last time they really did it really big was the Somewhere Over the Rainbow bit and the thing with Bob Hope, which was really creepy. Just the one last thing I gotta say is that bit with Bob Hope that Billy Crystal introduced, where Bob Hope's like, "And now your next presenters, Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law." It was so creepy. Like, I was like, "Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Zemeckis." And it was just like, you know, "Come on, the Polar Express." Like, it was so fucking creepy. Just Bob Hope calling out these names of people that are around when he's dead.
Gross.
It's so creepy. Like, there's a difference between... It's the Uncanny Valley, man. There's a big difference between, "Oh, that's cool that this dead fellow who hosted the Oscars once is talking about the star of Iron Man and the fellow who played Alfie in the remake nobody saw." And then, like, versus, you know, "Come on, the Polar Express!" Like, it's the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And then there's Han Solo. He acts like he doesn't care, but he does. Yeah.
Don't forget what... Then here we have a CGI stormtrooper and
Tom Hanks in the Polar Express.
Ugh, now I'm scared.
Yeah.
Right, you're in the valley.
Yeah, we're getting late into the show. We're starting to just
ramble.
Get delirious. So I want to apologize, one, to my... Are we wrapping this up?
Yes.
I think we're wrapping it up for the 2011 Oscar show. So I'm going to go ahead and apologize profusely to my listeners for the damnable fan, which has been running since about minute 5. I'm so, so sorry that you've had to listen to the fan keep cutting in and out every time we stop talking. I deeply apologize, and I'm going to figure out how to make this not a thing anymore. Nick's going to be fine, because his mic's on the top of his computer, and your computer isn't making a sound.
Yeah.
Why does yours not get hot? But mine does.
Mine's a newer model, I guess.
No, same model. You just got the bigger one.
Oh, maybe that's why.
That's a load of crap.
One thing I want to say, though. One last thing. I really liked how Steven Spielberg tried to make the losers feel better about themselves.
That was a great moment. Yeah.
Because he was like, "Hey, winners, you will join a list of films that includes blah 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 blah. If you don't win, you'll be with a list of films that includes Citizen Kane,
The Graduate,
and all these other amazing movies. So either way, you're in good company."
Yeah, yeah.
And both Jeff and I were like, "Oh, that's nice."
It was like the most awesome, genuine idea that had been put forth all night.
Yeah,
like it was a great moment.
So congrats, Steven Spielberg. And then he did that thing he did where it made him look like a South Park character who just whipped his head back and forth for like 15 seconds.
Because he's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. Anyway, I love Steven Spielberg.
I there was a short time where I was kind of like, he's a little too full of himself, but now I'm kind of back on board with he's just a delightful guy who loves movie magic.
Yeah,
I'm kind of on board with that again. Versus Tim Burton, which they won't be able to see the visual of this, but they want to see my impression of Tim Burton, which is actually Kevin Smith's impression of Tim Burton.
Sure,
I'm just a goofy artist. I like movie magic.
Bing, 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 bing. Dilly, dilly,
dilly, dilly. Bum, 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 bum. Oh,
it's better with two people.
It's true. We really need to wrap this up, though. Okay. We're getting into onomatopoeia, and that's not fun for anyone except for us. So anyway, that was the 2011 Oscar show. I'll let Nick go ahead and say goodbye to his folks.
All right. You've been listening to a co-production between Cinemantics, the original, unoriginal... Oh, shit. It's late.
Just the two of them.
Just the two of them. Cinematics.
Doing it the best I can. That was the theme from Just the Ten of Us.
Oh.
That was a show.
What about my... Eight is Enough.
Eight is Enough. Eight is Enough. I don't know what the theme of Eight is Enough is. I thought you were going to say My Two Dads, because I know the theme from My Two Dads.
My left foot will always be better than the right one.
My left foot won an Oscar once.
It did. I tied it back in there.
You can count on me! That's the theme for My Two Dads. Seriously, let's end this donkey show.
Seriously.
Okay.
Co-production. Cinemantics.
Original podcast.
Podcast with movies good and bad, mostly bad.
Mostly good, you mean? Mostly bad? Mostly...
Yeah. And...
The original unoriginal podcast.
Wow, that was odd.
That was... Okay. It was as odd as something else they're going to hear.
which is
one of the two things they're going to hear. Oh, God. Well, anyway, okay. That was that, and that was the 2011 Oscar show. My fan is getting louder. I do need to wrap this up. That was the OUP for this week. I'm Jeff Hedley.
I'm Nick Melton.
Go experience 7 days.
Don't eat the crab dip! Yay!
What?